Hello all and welcome to the weekly Community Credentials Group. It is great to have everyone. Today we are going to be talking about the use of verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers in government, thanks to Mr. Anil John. Just a quick note first, two things. One is that this meeting, as with all meetings at W3C, is covered under the Code of Ethics and Professional Content, a professional conduct, a link to which I have put in the chat here. And while this meeting is open to the public and totally all fair game, and feel free to participate all you want, if you are participating on any actual technical work items or contributing in any significant capacity to work items, you must be a member of the Community Credentials Group. And I put a link to join that as well, largely for IPR reasons, just to make sure that, you know, we don't get saddled with something that's copyrighted or patented, etc. This meeting is being recorded and will go out to our meetings page along with all the other ones. We are finally, I think, getting caught up on all of our transcripts and backlogs, etc. And just a quick note that while we do conduct this meeting by voice, we do use the Jitsi chat or IRC, so the chat box there, to manage queuing. So, and I think this is tied to the raise hand function as well. Now it does seem to be working that way, but you can also just type Q followed by plus into the chat, and it will add yourself to the queue, and Q minus, etc. And then at that point, the moderator of the meeting, in this case me, will go ahead and call on you when there's a good break in the conversation, etc. Do be aware that we, just be respectful of time. If you see a bunch of people stacked on the queue, let's make sure everyone gets a chance to ask their questions, etc. I'm going to pause here for any introductions and reintroductions. Is there anyone new to the meeting that has not been on before, or who has changed roles that would like to let us know about their role change?
Hello?
Yes.
My name's Gilad Rosner. I've been historically a researcher and consultant in the space of digital identity and privacy and information policy. And recently I joined a consultancy called Liminal Strategy Partners that focuses on digital identity and a range of related topics. And I'm particularly interested in the verifiable credentials standards work and use cases and applications.
Awesome. Great to have you. And feel free to join the CCG proper if you have not already. Otherwise, just feel free to hop into these meetings. And everyone here is pretty friendly and the mailing list is reasonably active. So great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Any other introductions or anyone new?
Hi, I think I should introduce myself. I'm Mateusz Obsamolowski. I work on the part of the team on GovUK One Login. And we do use VCs a lot.
Awesome.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Excellent. Any other new intros here? All right, cool. With that, a quick check for any announcements or reminders for the community. And Mr. Manu.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, a couple of announcements. The first one is, as many of you know, the World Wide Web Consortium is going through the legal entity transition this month and next month. And that means that it is going to be a very busy time for people in management at W3C and chartering and all that kind of stuff. All that to say that we do not expect any new anything to happen at W3C in December and January other than making sure that the legal entity makes the transition successfully and all that kind of stuff. So that's the first kind of level setting thing. That means more than likely that new work or work transitioned into Verifiable Credentials Working Group is going to be delayed. That probably also means discussions around the verifiable credential API. in questions around, you know, whether the charter allows that or whether we need to recharter or any of that stuff. Now is probably not a good time to pursue that because of the larger existential thing that's going on at W3C. So I think we can expect to see a bit of a pause in, you know, work transitioning, new work being picked up, you know, in VCWG. This is just me speaking as an individual. But that is kind of what I'm seeing. However, work on things like crypto suites, works on the verifiable credential API, will continue in the credentials community group. So today we are starting up, our meetings again on verifiable credential API. We will continue to process issues and, work on that specification. As many of you know, we have 17 implementations of, various aspects of the verifiable credentials API, thanks to the Jobs for the Future Plugfest. And so we're going to continue moving forward with that specification and crypto suites that are associated with some of the work that happened at JFF Plugfest 2. The last announcement is that planning is in motion to have a face-to-face meeting for Verifiable Credentials Working Group early next year. So just a heads up. To those of you that might be interested in participating there, that there are plans of a US-based face-to-face meeting early next year for verifiable credentials. That's it.
Yeah, thanks, Manu. I 100% concur with everything you said, and I did want to note something that I did note to Drummond in the chat, which is CCG should be basically unaffected. So if you've got new work you want to start on, feel free to, you know, open an issue, get the work item process started, et cetera. Just be aware if there is something for some reason that has to go back to staff, like things that are transitioning into working groups, those are the things that will likely be delayed. The other note before I call on Lucy here is that with that transition, there are two important things going on right now at W3C proper. One is an election for a couple of open seats on the TAGS, the Technical Architecture Group, as well as on the advisory board. So if you are an AC rep or if your member organization's AC rep has not voted, please do poke them and make sure that they get their votes in on that, because it is an interesting time period from a transition standpoint. The board has their hands full. A number of the current members of the new board of directors shifted over from the AB, so there are seats available on the AB, and those do need to be backfilled. So, Lucy, I see you on the queue.
Thanks, Michael. Can you hear me fine?
Yep, coming through.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I just want to share an update. I think a few months ago, I believe it was Kalia shared about on our project that the CMDL alliance phase of the project. So I want to share a link. So in case, you haven't read it yet. So it's a friend link. So, you know, you don't have to go through the paywall of Medium. And like the main findings from our first phase of this community engagement project is pretty much we realize there are, how market are, I kind of have better perspective of how market are seeing, kind of whether the conflicts were the alignment between the two standards. And also we define like the market seeing it more like, less so of like two separate standards, as you know, many of us who are deep in the standard world see, but more like how standards can work together to provide them like complete and end-to-end solutions. So coming out of that kind of like understanding, so we propose a more kind of less standard technology driven, but more kind of market implementation driven analysis and also related efforts in the letter. And the goal, and also based on that recommendation, we're also, gauging interest for potential next phase of the project. And I think want to be clear, like the goal of this, like this next phase where this project is to identify how these two things collide, but more so like in the market, less so probably at this point in the standard group, because at least we can't influence too much what is going on in the standard group. And eventually to achieve, and I think three things we mentioned very, very clearly in the letter. First thing is how we can help the market to develop an understanding of where each standard can provide unique values. And then second, for implementers to build on these standards with ease. And then lastly, and very, very importantly for users, like each individual like us, to manage credentials, you know, build on those standards with very good experience. So I just want to share this. And, you know, we have a sign up form in the letter. So if you're interested in full, you know, in keep getting updates and potentially participating in the next phase, you can sign up through the form and we'll keep you updated. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Lucy. Really appreciate all yours and Kalia's hard work on that. And obviously appreciate all the support from Wayne and Spruce on that as well. I mean, it's a very, very important topic. And we are glad to see y'all putting all the hard work into it, because it's not fun and it takes work. So really can't give enough big cheers. So for starting to work on that. Yes, and I see, I'm sure Emil will not comment at all about this when we finally let him talk. I think there is one last item just to touch base on, which, Jack, if you're on, I know you've got a good pull request out. Would you mind sharing a link to that and getting visibility in from the community, as well as an ask all and feedback, et cetera, on that?
Hey, sure. You want me to briefly introduce that now, right?
Yeah, that'd be great. Just a quick intro and then a link to the PR so that folks can comment, etc.
Sure. So at the Autonomy Foundation, me and one of my colleagues, Rebel, have been working on an implementation using one of the verification method proof types. It's currently called verifiable conditions. And this was a W3C CCG standard. We have, since the last meeting, updated the name to conditional proof. This is to have a less of an acronym clash with verifiable credentials, so VCs and VCs. So the first thing is that we have a PR. It's been approved by one of the other co-authors and ready to just have that name change done in your repositories. I think it also makes sense for you guys to update the repository slug as well. That's the first thing. And the second thing is we've actually implemented this condition, verifiable conditions, that allows you to present delegated and multi-signature condition types inside a DID document. And we've implemented a verifiable credentials library that allows you to sign verifiable credentials with multiple or delegated signatures or combinations of the two. And it uses this verification method standard to prove that the condition was met. So I've just shared two links. The first is a blog article that introduces the bigger scope of work, having verifiable credentials with multi-signature and delegated signatures. So that gives an overview. I think this is this work we've done from the Decentralized Identity Foundation repositories, and we've now got the links to our work there with the pull requests to a branch that represents upstream. So you can see exactly what we've done on those repositories. That we haven't got a pull request to the upstream diff branches yet. I think it'd be great for the community to start understanding what this standard looks like and having a more in-depth discussion. Probably at a later call. The second link I have there is the link to the pull request on the verifiable conditions W3C CCG repo, which we would like approved.
Awesome. So I know you're an editor on that work item, so obviously you contributing that is good. I think Marcus and or I forget who the other kind of core admin is on that. Looks like maybe Casper. So at any point, obviously, just Marcus, et cetera, as long as you know, it's merged, I think you're fine. So appreciate the hard work on this.
Thanks, and looking forward to some feedback and people to get excited about multi-signature VCs and the like.
Awesome. Cool. Sounds good. Well, thanks so much again. And with that, let me just double check. I think that is the last. Any kind of final announcements or anything we missed here before we turn it over to Anil? Kalia.
I'll share that we are working on an event inspired by IIW happening in APAC. In Thailand specifically, so it's the APAC Digital Identity Unconference, and our dates for that are March 1 to 3, with March 1 being an evening welcome reception and 2 days of unconference in Bangkok. So if you are in APAC, we invite you. If you have colleagues who are based in that region that you'd like to participate in a community event similar to IIW, but centered around APAC and the community there. I am sharing a save the date, Drummond. There isn't a link yet, but it will be coming. And as soon as it is available, I'll post it to the list.
Awesome. Thank you, Kalia. Cool. Well, with that, Mr. Anil John, I'm going to hand the ball to you to kick us off and talk about the topic for the day.
So, Mike, I have sort of a open-ended thing, right? So I will simply note that it's going to be a stream of consciousness. Forgive me. But I'd rather, you know, have questions, you know, from the members here more than anything else. And part of it is also, I just, you know, got back, from spending a week, combination of London meeting with the UK government folks, as well as the European Commission, as well as obviously attending along with Kalia and some of the other members here, the ESIPS Labs final event in Brussels as well. So a little bit of, you know, pieces all over the place, but I will simply start, since Kalia spoke recently, I will simply note that I had one of the strangest conversations that I've ever had in my government career this morning, whereby, it seems like one of the leaders of our Office of Biometric Identity Management, OBIM, attended the last, IIW and was was enthusiastic about the conversations that they had, ended up talking to them about, you know, what they wanted to do in order to engage the community a whole lot more. So I just found that it is rare when people who are sort of very much in the government space engage with communities like IIW and realize there is a broader ecosystem that has a very interesting and diverse viewpoint. And it's even rarer when they recognize that there is incredible amount of value in engaging with them to understand the perspectives of not just the large technology vendors, but the actual the people who actually end up being on the recipient and the use of the technology. So I think whatever you guys did at the last IIW to engage with them, please keep doing more of that, because that was a refreshing engagement on my side. So just want to let you know that. Separately, like I said, I had a set of conversations that I had when I was in Europe last week. And what I'll do is I'll at least share the perspective that I was taking with me into those conversations, even if I will differ from sharing what the response from the counterparty organizations were, right? I want to be respectful of their position, but at least I'll sort of articulate some of the conversations that we brought to the table in doing that. And I know that there are people from the European Union companies from there on the table. And by the way, I was hoping that I would actually run into David Chadwick in person, and I did not. I regret that in some ways, because I thought that he was part of the ESIF lab group as well. But hopefully one of these days we will meet up in person one of these days as well. But separately, first and foremost, it is interesting to engage with the startup community and the innovative community in Europe and realize that for them, blockchain is not a dirty word, right? So I think it was interesting for me in that realizing for them that is probably in some way shaped by the EU perspective on, you know, ensuring a competitive ecosystem and probably the, you know, the alignment of the philosophy around the blockchain technology more than anything else. But as it relates to the verifiable credential and the decentralized identity community, one recommendation that I would absolutely have regarding that is to engage actually with the EU's EBCI initiative, which is the European Blockchain something, you know, I forget the last two words that goes with the acronym, primarily because what I took away from the conversations with them and some of the questions that I had with them is they're suffering from the same branding challenge that I have on the Silicon Valley Innovation Program. Like my program is called the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, but majority of our companies from outside the Valley, and we fund companies, globally as well. So Silicon Valley tends to be a branding for us. And for them, I think when they started, obviously blockchain technology was the globally visible, bright and shiny object. So they basically use that. But when you talk to them, what you realize is that they sort of evolved with the times and they're very much champions of using verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers in a broader ecosystem. And when they think about quote unquote blockchain, they sort of look at it as a resilient content distribution network for metadata and not for anything else. So I think there is value in this community sort of putting aside their, you know, in some ways their instinctive aversion to the term blockchain and engaging with them because they're actually doing some really interesting work there that's worthwhile to sort of understand. And I think you will find, you know, them to be receptive to what we are doing in this ecosystem as well, right? So separately, from the government perspective, there were a couple of things that I sort of took as on behalf of my partners in the work that we're doing, whether it is USCIS or CBP or our Office of Privacy there, right? And one of them was very simple, right? I think there was a public announcement just recently that the European Union has actually awarded the contract. The European Commission has awarded the contract for the development of the EUDI, European Digital Identity Wallet, to a combination of companies. Hang on for just 1 second. Not somebody that I normally interact with, a net company, Intrasoft and, Details AB. I'm sure I mangled the pronunciation of the last one. The last one is important because they are a company that obviously spends a lot of work in the mobile driver's license space. In fact, an old friend of mine, Jeff Schlegel, who used to be the head of identity management at Amber, works for them there as well. So, they are obviously, a remarkably competent company. It's going to be interesting in that where they sort of take it, and it'll be obviously given their background in MDL, support for the ISO MDL standard is going to be, I'm sure, something that they're going to be, putting into place. My sense in the variety of conversations that I had was, there is a significant amount of EU member states who are also interested in verifiable credentials and DIDs as well. So I would not be surprised if there is a broader acceptance for the standards more than anything else there. From the messages and the conversations that I was conveying in this was something along this line, right? So I think as a sovereign talking to another sovereign, we fully recognize that the European Union and the member states have full remit over how they want to conduct their business when it comes to the identity and the digital wallet piece of it. And obviously the policies that they're putting into place regarding you know, who is authoritative, how they determine who is authoritative and things like that are obviously something that is, you know, fully under their remit, and, you know, their decision to do. I think the question that I sort of asked them was two layers down. At the end of the road, one of the work streams that we have is with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, that we are in the business of issuing high-value digital immigration credentials to people who are citizens of other countries. And one of the questions that, and one of the things that we sort of opened the door for is twofold. One of them is, I think USCIS, I think they talked about this publicly, so I'm not sharing anything magical or secret. They are absolutely interested in working with other jurisdictions in order to consume their digital credentials as part of the adjudication process of granting somebody a benefit, you know, a benefit being a permanent resident card or a, you know, immigration, other types of immigration document or things like that. So there was a question that I asked on behalf of my, you know, partners about, you know, we believe this is a value to your citizens in order to make their life easier. Would there be any opportunity to work together on that? There was also a separate question that we asked as well, and that was very simple. We are going down the path with USCIS in, for lack of a better word, bring your own DID, bring your own wallet to our front door approach, right? That basically means that we're not going to basically, you know, push, you know, USCIS or DHS or the U.S. government as of right now have no plans to basically build a wallet for government that will be deployed to the community in general. Our desire is to basically leverage the broader ecosystem in order to do that. Having said that, the European Union has obviously made very clear that they are, give me just one second, that they are going down the path of obviously ensuring that every EU citizen would have a digital wallet of their own. So one of the questions that we asked was, we would love a future where a European citizen with their EU member state issued digital wallet has the ability to come to a USCIS infrastructure and be able to actually receive a digital immigration credentials from us rather than them having to find some other approved wallet. In order to get to that point, obviously there has to be some conversation about, you know, is there a common equivalency between the security, privacy and interoperability aspects of the wallet? So that we can all, you know, build on the same common foundation. And the question that was being, that we asked was, is there an interest in doing so? Right. So that's like I said, I want to be transparent from, at least from our perspective, on what the questions that we were asking were. So that was one. The second one obviously is on the other trade side. Obviously global trade is a big deal for us. And one of the other work streams that we have is the digitization of trade documents, whether it is for agriculture, oil and natural gas, steel, e-commerce imports into the U.S. And we're also going down the path, for our trusted trader program, potentially to be issuing credentials to our exporters, with mutual recognition, by other counterparties as well. So the question is, you know, we're interested in this. Global trade is obviously of mutual interest to all of it. Is there interest in working together on this? And, so those were some of the questions that we were asking. And last but not least, separately, on the SVIP side, we are actually currently, you know, having discussions with our, you know, DHS Office of Privacy potentially around a future time frame to be determined, specifics to be determined around a open solicitation around privacy enhancing technologies, which is, I think, something of great interest to a variety of communities, both on the private sector side and on the public sector side. In general, I want to be very clear that when we talk about privacy enhancing technologies, we often run into what some of my colleagues call the privacy industrial complex, which is a way of describing people who would love to look at a problem, admire it from 15 different directions, articulate how wonderful and beautiful the problem is, then ask for funding to admire it some more, which is not what we want for a solicitation through SVIP. We're looking for, you know, something that is very, very near term and useful across the broader community. And is there an opportunity to sort of ensure that any type of solution obviously is interoperable on a global basis? So that's my one thing to the community in general. I'm really interested in getting your perspective on the privacy side of the house. What are some perhaps tractable problems that you see that people are not addressing in any way, shape or form, and not, you know, magical, you know, homomorphic encryption, zero knowledge proofy kind of thingies where, there's a whole bunch of other things that come along for the ride as well. Really, I'm happy to, you know, happy to get the feedback from the community. Again, Mike, I think that's like sort of the random bit of conversations on the government perspective, both in the public and the private sector. I'd rather take questions and sort
that,
of.
Yeah, no, that was awesome. And on the privacy side, I mean, I'll just chip in something that, you know, we're dealing with, obviously, which is privacy around machine learning data, especially as we're looking at things like, you know, dense passage retrieval and sparse indexing and things like what is powering ChatGPT and a whole bunch of other systems. We've been layering in models to try to intersect and prevent that, you know, data that could be identifying an individual before it even gets into the system. But there's no standardized way of approaching this or way of dealing with this. That might be the WebML group over here at W3C. It might be somewhere else. I don't know. But that's an area that's very, that, you know, is very nebulous and is very problematic across the industry. And all I see is a bunch of hand waving around it saying, ah, bias bad, privacy data, you know, PII bad, but no real practical, like, well, let's all agree on a way to go take some concrete steps to solve it. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that side of it?
I do. And I agree with you, you know, from that perspective. Also, again, that is not really my swim lane more than anything else. So anything that I say can be, is either going to be incomplete or misconstrued. So I'd rather provide you the feedback directly rather than publicly, because I know I will get wrong and I'd rather be correct.
I
would also note that one of the things that I've spent, in my R&D days was around the fact that it is very hard for a government organization in order to provide training data to somebody that we're working with. It simply, right. You know, it's not a path to success, right? So I spend a lot of time in basically trying to generate synthetic data that is actually really modeled to the greatest extent on how real data looks. And I'm not sure how much work is being done in order to sort of understand the fidelity of the data, because fundamentally, I do not believe in de-anonymizing technologies, full stop. Mm-hmm. Right? So, yes. So I believe that they are, you know, they're snake oil. We need a better approach to, you know, training information and things like that. The other piece that I think that, you know, I'm sort of, you know, struggling with is basically, selective disclosure is something that is incredibly important to the people that I'm working with and in the technology that we're looking at, whether it is BBS signatures, or some other scheme. And what I don't see is a path to ensuring that selective disclosure capabilities, can be implemented using quantum safe cryptography. Yes. So really, really interested in that aspect of it. And if people have a sense of where who is thinking about it, what they're doing with it, I would love to learn a little bit more and pick their brains and things like that.
And Tobias and I have been having that conversation a lot. The only folks I know who are looking at that in any serious way right now is IBM Research. I could obviously make some intros over there. To date, that's the only folks that are seriously hammering that side of selective disclosure and potential approaches, but it's early, right? It's moved. I mean, it's like 2-3 years into like hard testing on some stuff, but that's early in cryptography, right? So, Panu.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Go ahead, Manu.
And good to hear your voice, Neil. So I've got a question. It's on the selective disclosure thing, right? Because this was a question that was raised by a number of people that are operating out of the EU and hoping to, deploy verifiable credentials. And they basically said, why is BBS Plus the only selective disclosure mechanism that's being looked at? You know, why are there not other mechanisms being looked at? Now there is work in SDJOD, but I would say that, you know, the community in general seems to be targeting BBS Plus as the selective disclosure plus unlinkable signature mechanism. And it seems that some of the folks in the EU are saying, no, that's not good enough, because what we actually need is we need NIST approved cryptography. So the plain old vanilla stuff that's been used for 20 plus years, but we need a selective disclosure mechanism there. And what I've noticed is that the second we start hinting that we're going to work on something like that, something like SDJOT, you get people that push back and say, oh no, you shouldn't do that because, you get traceability with that type of selective disclosure. And so you should be doing something more akin to CL signatures or BBS Plus. So, I think one of the traps we're in right now, is we're stuck between a rock and a hard place, where we have the EU saying you will do selective disclosure, but not being very specific about what they mean, as far as I know. And you've got, you know, people that are really pushing the unlinkability stuff, going, you should not do selective disclosure unless you also do unlinkability. And if you work on something that's not that, expect to be attacked, right? I mean, expect to have the privacy, quote unquote defenders of privacy come after you because you're providing a mechanism that allows, you know, tracking of individuals. I'm wondering, Anil, I'm wondering if you found out anything about kind of this line of thinking out of the EU in your meetings last week with them. And I'm wondering if there's anyone, from the EU that's been looking at those regulations a bit more closely, that is reading something different, out of that requirement. That's it.
So Manu, I'll be blunt in saying that I don't think we got into that level of, looking in the weeds on this one, right? I would simply note that selective disclosure is important capability for us, simply because, predicate proofs and implementations of it, I've learned, pretty painfully in past lives that unless there is a liability model around when things go wrong, wrapped around it, and no technology vendor seems to be, hold themselves liable for their beautiful map, and no relying party will actually believe that. So for us, selective disclosure is important. There was receptiveness to ensuring that the quantum safe signature, quantum safe implementation of selective disclosure is something that is worthwhile. Got positive reception to that in a particular conversational thread, but I didn't really go down to that level of detail in nuancing the policy, so couldn't give you a good answer there.
And Neil, kind of following on to that, I mean, would you have any opposition to use of like SDJWT now that it's been getting significantly streamlined and improved with like dilithium and or, P256 or something like that as mechanisms to provide that in a FIPS NIST?
Mr. Prorock, are you trying to like walk me into a corner at this point?
Of course.
So show me how that can work with a semantically aware JSON linked data structure, a JSON LD based credential format. So I will simply note that it is going to be so. So I got asked this question publicly by, I think Paul knows, I know that he participates here as well. So, about the current, shall we say, interesting discussions around ad context and things like that, which I basically said that I would not engage on, in general. I will simply note that, some of the arguments from as a end user and of a technology. What I will convey from the usage of this technology within the context of both USCIS and US Customs is that verifiable credentials and digitally signed attestations are a piece of the puzzle and piece of the business process that they look at on the CBP side in order to determine whether goods coming into the country are something that they can allow in, whether they will stop or they want to know more about. And for us, the semantic overlay to JSON AAA, JSON LD, is basically something that is important to us to do the analytics on the data that is coming in. So it is not about making life easier for developers or harder for developers or the like. It is about actually solving a business problem on our end, and we need that data to actually be commonly understood on both sides of the wire. So from my perspective, feel free to have the conversations that you guys need to have from a technical implementation perspective, but do make sure that your conversations are also going down the path of actually solving the problems of end customers and not making it easy just for selling product, right? So
fully agree. And I think you're getting at something important, which is those semantics are really important from a machine learning side. Ori, I see you on the queue.
Yeah, I was just cued to comment on some of what's, there's a lot of topics coming up here, they're frustratingly all tangled together. The comment that I'm cued to make is that post-quantum resiliency is something that benefits all higher order schemes and envelope formats. And so I think it is a mistake to conflate benefits of a new system with fundamental new cryptography. And I like to have nice clean layers where I can add quantum resilience to JSON Web Signature and Cozy Sign 1, and then layer on top of JSON Web Signature and Cozy Sign 1 other higher order pieces. And if you have to sort of buy into an entirely new envelope format to get a fundamentally new cryptographic benefit or primitive, I think there's risks associated with that kind of approach. And also it's less sort of helpful to the broader community that might already have built dependencies on JSON Web Signature or Cozy Sign 1. And so, I think in terms of the post-quantum side, I think we should be focused on making sure post-quantum is solved for in a generic manner. And in terms of the selective disclosure versus unlinkability comments, I think there are problems with the approach when adding those two constraints together limits you essentially to, one or two schemes. And I think that the industry needs to solve for those problems with the appropriate layering so that there's enough cryptographic agility around unlinkability or progressive or selective disclosure, so that you're not committed to one cryptographic hardness problem in the unlikely event that that hardness problem ends up being not so hard. That's it.
Thank you, Ori. I actually wanted to answer the comment that actually Drummond made that CBP does not have a need for selective disclosure. I will simply note that in an internal conversation that we were having with CBP, I made the exact same comment, Drummond, and I was basically yelled at out of the room, right? And their comment very simply was, it was this, right? So, I will contrast the perspectives, right? USCIS considers selective disclosure for the credentials that issues to be incredibly important from a privacy and giving control to individuals in what they disclose to a counterparty. CBP, on the other hand, does not look at selective disclosure from a quote unquote, privacy perspective. They look at it actually from a selective disclosure of business information that is relevant to CDP from the private sector. So there is a whole bunch of information that is presented by trade to CDP that may or may not be relevant to the CDP from a business perspective and what they're asking for. And giving the, you know, trade counterparties who interact with CDP using verifiable credentials based and decentralized identifier based, digital documents, and giving them the ability to selectively share only portions of that information with CDP is something that is really, really of value to both the trading counterparties and to CDP. So for them, they don't look at it from the privacy perspective, but they do look at it from the selective disclosure of business perspective to CBP as a use case there. Hopefully that was helpful.
Yeah, and I'll add in an agricultural case that I'm just like very intimately familiar with. Like when you think about, and this I think extends beyond government, right? This is more just in general, right? If you think about like a health and safety inspection at a facility, well, the inspecting body may wish to reveal to someone purchasing from, say a food processing facility, jam, right? So I want to buy the strawberry jam. Well, did they pass the health and safety inspections? Sure. That party does not necessarily need to know all of the details or other suppliers that seller is working from, et cetera. So there are a lot of selective disclosure use cases in trade, Drummond.
So I also want to move beyond selective disclosure to some of the other privacy pieces as well. The one thing that I'll note, and one of the things that we are very concerned about is basically informed consent and the implications to the mosaic effect, right? So I think one of the challenges that I think that we face, particularly when you're actually providing a lot of agency and control to an individual and what they can basically selectively disclose to a counterparty with consent, is that over time, cognitively, you lose track of the amount of consent that you've given to a counterparty. And over time, that counterparty could actually build up a very good profile of you that or based on the data that you shared with consent, because you've actually lost track of the amount of consent that you've given. So, consent management at scale, revocation of consent, both from a UI, from a larger cognitive perspective, feels like a problem space that we're not adequately addressing. It feels as though that is an area that we need to put some emphasis on, and that we need some clear solutions that are actually potentially, integrated into whether it is a digital wallet or whether it is an issuer infrastructure or whether it is a verifier infrastructure. I don't know. I'm not sure where the right places are, but that's also one of the other things that we are sort of thinking over as being something that is very near term and very real.
Awesome. Maybe.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. I have no clear answers on the best way to approach that. I do agree that it's probably a big area that this community, as well as its sister communities, need to focus on. I was going to ask a slightly different question or a concern, right? Voice a concern and then ask a question of kind of you as someone that works for government, Anil. So as everyone has probably seen, there's like this big rush to make digital wallets a thing, right? There's all this talk about digital wallet standardization and open source versus open standards, and they all seem like they're on a collision course in 2023. There are various groups and companies that are saying that they know what the next generation protocol is going to be, or it's going to be X, and wallets are going to work exactly like Y. Personally, I think this is just all premature and grandstanding, right? But that is going to be one of the big things that happens in 2023. You've got EU pushing out with this. They've allocated money to someone to build an open digital wallet. There are, as we saw in the Jobs for the Future Plugfest, multiple digital wallets speaking multiple different protocols with multiple different kind of wire level data formats. That does not seem like it's going to be reconciled anytime soon. Some people are claiming that there will be one winner. Others are saying, no, we're looking at a multi-protocol, multi-format future. I'm wondering how you, Anil, and if you've had a chance to talk with anyone in the EU, are going to navigate that kind of tumult in the ecosystem. Thoughts?
Always have a lot of thoughts on this, and primarily because I think it, the reality is that I think first of all, let me just back up as a, you know, a two-lane constraint that I saw, you know, regarding the ongoing, you know, fascinating conversation around MDL versus, and it's very easy to say versus VC when the reality of our identity ecosystem is we still work with systems that use that dreaded WSDR protocols. We still work with systems that use SAML, and we use obviously things like OpenID Connect and OAuth as well. So I do fully anticipate that going forward, we absolutely will live in a multi-protocol, multi-credential format world. The question, and any desire by one community in order to sort of make the other community bend the knee is going to result in basically allergic reaction and a lack of a path to success, right? So I do think that we do need a better approach that recognizes the fact that basically the starting point for the MDL and the VCs were actually very different. VCs were focused on presentation of credentials over the web. MDL was focused on presentation of credentials in person, and that specific choices were made in order to enable that. And now you're sort of, you know, trying to, you know, conquer the world. And we sort of need to find a way to sort of make sure that we have a path forward. I do not know what the path forward is, but I definitely resonated with Kalia's and Lucy's in-depth research on it, given that they actually spend the time to do the research and talk to a variety of people on that. I do think that I want to be very clear, at least my perspective of the award that the European Commission made is not for building a wallet for the EU. It was for building, for lack of a better word, a reference implementation of a wallet that actually they're going to use to inform, you know, their policy on what standards to support, what the scalability of that implementation are. So if you actually look at the award, and I'll actually, you know, try to put a link to the actual, you know, tender award piece. You know, somebody sent me a link to that actual. You will notice that it is very much about a reference implementation. So it's not a done deal. It's my sense of that is they're using that to make sure that the rubber actually meets the road on their policy, right? So, and not trying to make sure that you have a policy without actually closing the loop with the technology and implementation. And they're using this tender as a mechanism to build and sort of, you know, figure out what is real, what can be supported. So I think it is important for, you know, the community in general to sort of ensure that feedback is provided to that effort so that it actually informs what the ultimate end state is. Beyond that, obviously, you know, we're very interested in the work that we're doing in making sure that the, at the end of the road, we want to make it easy for our customers, the citizens, the immigrants, the people who actually consume our credentials and to whom we issue our credentials, such that they can actually manage, own, and control their interactions, whether it is a private sector or the public sector, in a manner that is not, that makes their life easier. And they have confidence in the integrity and the privacy of the data that is there to begin with. I don't have magical answers for you, Manu, other than I think it is really important for us to continue the conversation, make sure that we bring the diversity of perspectives, whether it is on a cross-jurisdictional level or if it is from different communities together. And any desire to play a zero-sum game is fundamentally a bad strategy in the current ecosystem, because it's not going to get you what you think you're going to get. That's the best I can offer you at this point in time, Manu.
Awesome. That was super helpful. Well, I think we're kind of at time here, unfortunately. This is a great conversation. Anil, I really appreciate your time today, as I'm sure many others do. And then just keep us posted, obviously, on the chair side if you have any other updates around things like profiles and other things that can be shared broader with the community to help provide implementation guidance, et cetera, so that we can all work with government systems and vice versa better, right, and make our whole.
Yeah, I just want to be very clear, right? I'm absolutely happy to do that for the primary reason from a self-preservation perspective, which is we do not want government bespoke or
yes.
systems that work.
Exactly.
Scale globally.
Yeah.
And so anything that we can do in order to make sure that we do it, but we are also going to be very mindful of desires to sort of, in order to create the rails that sort of limit competition and limit choice. So, yeah. So that's something that we're going to be watching as we obviously ensure that whatever we're supporting is moving down the very visible and open ecosystem side of the house here.
That was much, much appreciated as always, and a big breath of fresh air compared to a lot of the behind closed doors, locked up stuff. So, once again, thank you as always for the broad support. With that, I'm going to say thank you, everyone. Really appreciate your time, questions, comments in the chat, etc. Feel free to continue conversation on the list, and obviously feedback into the chairs if we need to add, remove topics, change topics, etc., as always. But we've been so far hearing great feedback. Thanks especially to my co-chairs, Harrison and Kimberly, for really working together on all this stuff. So it's been great to kind of see everything coming together here. With that, we can go ahead and stop recording, and happy Tuesday, and on to the next meetings. So, thank you again, all.